Hello, and welcome to the 17th episode of Tooncast, brought to you by the Geekcast Radio Network. I'm your host, TFG1 Mike, and joining me today is Derek Ferguson from Better in the Dark on Earth2.net. Hello.
Hey, Mike, how are you doing? How you doing, folks?
Doing pretty good. Yes, we're going to be talking about Tailspin today.
Yay!
This is going to be one of the most memorable 90s Disney themes that just gets stuck in your head. We'll talk...
Oh, Leo, Tailspin. Oh, Leo, yeah. One of the best ones, next to the Rescue Rangers. I like Tailspin. It all depends on my mood, though, but I think Tailspin takes the edge in favorite theme song.
Yeah, I would argue Darkwing Duck, but whatever. You know.
Oh yeah, well, let's get dangerous. I mean, you know, yeah, that. I mean, you know, so they were all good out of that whole Disney afternoon block of cartoons that they had. Yep. They all were good, really.
Yep. And that's actually what got Tooncast started. My friend Mike Dodd over at This Week in Geek, he and his podcasting people did an episode of their show just on the Disney afternoon, talking about all of the cartoons within like an hour, and that's actually what got the idea for Tooncast going. So,
okay.
And then technically we're up to 18 episodes now, so that works. We've covered a lot of ground since we started.
And how do you enjoy it so far, this podcast? Because I've been doing it for 2 years, and it's still, you know, like blowing my mind that people actually listen. our podcast, you know, really, you think that nobody's listening to it, and then, you know, you get responses from people, and you say, oh, wow, well, I guess people are listening to it.
Yeah. I've been doing it since December of last year is when I started. At first I was like, you know, I was pretty much like a deer in headlights, like, oh, wow, this is almost like real radio, so I have to, like, be really professional. And then I just said, screw it, and I'm just going to be, you know, really calm and just, you know, I really don't care. Should let you know that we are explicit, so if you want to curse, you don't have to worry about that.
Oh, okay, fine.
You know.
No, yeah, but I understand exactly what you mean when you talk about the deer in the headlight things, because when me and Tom DJ, me and my, you know, my partner, when we started doing our podcast, I was, like, very stiff and formal and watching what I said and everything like that. And when I listened to it afterwards, I said, well, that's no fun. It wasn't any fun for me, and I know it wasn't any fun for the people listening, and it wasn't any fun for Tom. And then we started treating it more as just a dialogue, like you're just talking to people. And then that's when it started to click for us, at least.
Exactly. Oh, yeah. I completely agree with that. And I think that was once I finished TFG1, because I actually sped that up. And most people already know this, but I actually sped that show up. It was originally supposed to run 2 years. I sped it up, and I finished it in 6 months because Steve and I had all these other ideas for other shows.
Oh, so, okay.
You know, yeah, and now that I've, you know, I've done the math. I probably have close to, I don't know, 60, 70 episodes of just total shows under my belt. And I prefer the, you know, more relaxed, laid-back conversation. I'm not the type of person that watches time. So if an episode goes 2 hours, it goes 2 hours. If it doesn't, it doesn't. I mean, it just depends on what we have to say about whatever the topic is.
Yeah, me and Tom are pretty much like that, Better in the Dark, too. We got some people that were complaining about, because we did an episode on Batman, mm-hmm. where we covered the movies, and that ran about like 2 hours. And, you know, like I said to the people that was complaining, I said, well, you know something? You don't have to listen to the whole 2 hours all at one time.
Yeah, exactly.
You can listen to some of it and then go do whatever you got to do in your real life and then come back later and listen to the rest. I mean, just because we sat up here for 2 hours recording it doesn't mean you have to listen to it for the whole 2 hours all at one time, you know. Yeah, but I agree with you 100%. I mean, you see where it takes you, because as you're talking, things come to your head and you remember things and stuff like that, and you say, okay, well, let me put this in, let me put that in. And, yeah, each episode, you know, takes as much time as it takes.
Yep, yep. But there are some podcasters out there that will, you know, will watch the time. I mean, on some episodes I will do it just because I really don't have that much to say, but, you know, there are some episodes or some podcasters that will be like, okay, well, we need to keep it to an hour, maybe a few minutes after an hour, and that's it. And people, you know, people that listen, because I, you know, I was a podcast listener. I started out listening to World's Finest Podcast by Michael David Sims from Earth2.net.
Oh yeah, yeah, wonderful podcast.
And James Doe. So I mean, but see, I like the longer episodes because it's more content from, you know, whoever I'm listening to. But then,
yeah.
Just a couple of quick programming notes. Steve, my co-host, had looked up the subscribers from iTunes, and TuneCast, as of September 30th, has 44 subscribers. So, yay.
Yay!
And we do have, I think we have nothing but positive feedback on iTunes as far as just the rating. I think we have 5 stars. I don't know. I mean, it really doesn't matter to me, really. I mean, honestly, I'm glad that people are liking the show.
Stop lying.
No, it matters, but
stop lying.
It matters, but I'm not like overly obsessive about it. I'm not like, you know, each time I go through an outro, I will say, you know, hey, you know, there's a way you can help us out. Go over to iTunes, leave us feedback, leave us reviews if you want to, you know.
Yeah.
So,
yeah.
But I mean, that's just the way, you know, word of mouth is the best way to get, you know, stuff out about these things.
Oh, absolutely, because that's how anytime anybody gets in touch with me and Tom about, you know, I always ask them, well, how did you find out about our podcast? And they'll say, oh, well, I heard it from somebody else. A friend of mine recommended it to me. So, yeah, word of mouth is, to me, the best advertising that you can get, because if you have a friend tell you, okay, you should listen to this, what are you going to do? You're naturally going to listen to it.
Yeah. Yeah, I actually have to listen to your old show. I haven't yet. I've just got so much going on with running like 6 of my own shows at once.
Well, listen, hey, don't worry about it. I understand. I mean, you know what? I don't get all bent out of shape.
Oh,
but you know what? I really haven't listened to your podcast. Well, yeah, because you're probably busy. I mean, people do have lives to do, you know. But when you do get a chance after we finish doing this, go listen.
Yes. Insert shameless plug here.
Yeah, exactly. Go listen to Better in the Dark.
Now, you guys are on iTunes, right? Because that's mainly where...
Yeah.
Okay.
Yeah, we're on iTunes.
Okay, because that's mainly where I get my podcast from, so...
Yeah, we got the RSS thingy hooked up and everything like that, so by all means, go ahead. We've only been on Earth2.net for a short time now, so there's only like 4 episodes, but we actually have about like 2 years worth. Like, we're up to episode 66 now. So, yeah, so we've got, like, quite a bit. And they're going to be up at the Earth2.net site soon, hopefully.
Yes. All right. We are going to be moving on to today's topic. We will be right back. It is now time for the history lesson. For episode 17, we travel back to 1990 with Tailspin. Tailspin is a half-hour American animated television series that first aired in 1990 as part of the Disney Afternoon, with characters adapted from Disney's 1967 animated feature, The Jungle Book. The name of the show is a play on T-A-I-L, Spin, the rapid descent of an aircraft in a steep spiral. Let's see here. After a preview of the Disney Afternoon that aired on the Disney Channel in early May 1990, the series began its first run September of that same year. The original concept was embodied in the introductory television movie Plunder and Lightning, which was nominated for an Emmy Award for Outstanding Animated Program.
And well deserved, at least so, because Plunder and Lightning, you know, and I remember actually seeing it when it was aired, the 2-hour movie version. It came on one Saturday afternoon, and as far as I know, and I was hoping maybe that you could tell me this, as far as I've been able to find out, it was only aired that one time.
Right, as the two-hour feature.
Right, and then it was cut up into the four half-hour episodes, you know, that would run for like a whole week, you know, on the regular thing.
Well, that's the thing. You know, you can show... Okay, the best example I can give you is the He-Man and She-Ra crossover movie introducing She-Ra, The Secret of the Sword.
Okay.
Apparently, that was a full 100-minute cut-together film of the first five episodes of She-Ra. If you go, and, you know, again, this is shameless plug time. If you go over to Earth2.net, look at episode 261 of Earth2.net, the show. Michael and his then-girlfriend, Jenny, they reviewed it, but they reviewed it as episodic. And the thing with this, with Plunder and Lightning, is what I think what they probably were trying to do is that once they showed it as a two-hour, they're like, okay, well, we need to get more showings of this out, and we don't want to have people sit there for 2 hours, so we'll break it up into four different parts, put a to-be-continued at the end of each one, so people have to come back the next afternoon to watch the next part.
Yeah, but that stinks, because I've heard that they, like, edited out, you know, like, quite a bit in order to make it fit into that half-hour, you know, time frame, which is really a shame, because that's what hooked me on Tailspin, because Plunder and Lightning, even if that had been, like, a live-action thing... I still, you know, I mean, it would have been a terrific movie. I mean, it's such a good story. It's terrific animated, or if they did it in live action. It was just a terrific adventure story. And Tailspin couldn't have had a better way to kick off the series than with Plunder and Lightning.
Oh, yeah. I mean, I completely agree. I was, you know, before we started recording this, I went back to YouTube and I watched some of it. And it's just, it's a great story. It's a great way to introduce the characters. I think they did a really nice job of updating the Jungle Book characters, because I know that two of the Jungle Book characters are brought over, which is Baloo the bear and Louie the orangutan, and they're portrayed as friends in Tailspin, whereas in the Jungle Book they were pretty much enemies. So it's nice to... I always find it really refreshing seeing like characters that you know from one thing in something else that you completely didn't see them in. That you see them in that situation.
Well, I'll be honest with you. I've seen the Jungle Book maybe once or twice, and that was so long ago, I hardly remember. I remember it because Phil Harris, well, of course, I love Phil Harris, you know, who did the voice of Baloo the Bear in it. And the only thing I can remember is like that musical number, I Want to Talk Like You or something like that. But I actually don't remember a whole lot about the movie. So when I started watching Tailspin, I knew these characters were from the Jungle Book, but it was really like I was being introduced to new characters I'd never seen before.
Right, right. Yep. Let's see, and as we said, it was later, you know, Plunder and Lightning was later re-edited into four half-hour episodes for reruns. The show was often seen either on its own half-hour show or as part of the two-hour syndicated series, The Disney Afternoon. Tailspin ended its 65th episode, which ran in 1991. However, reruns continued to be shown on The Disney Afternoon until September 1994. Afterwards, it was moved to Disney Channel and later to Toon Disney, where it was first aired from April 1998 until January 2006, later from January 07 to May 08. And that is the history lesson.
Which is where I was watching it obsessively. Yeah, because Toon Disney, and you know what? They would run it like in the afternoon, like 1 o'clock in the afternoon, and then like 1 o'clock in the morning.
Yep.
And my wife would say, you have a DVR. Why don't you just record the damn thing? I said, I'm up anyway, because usually since I'm a writer, that's my best time to write, late at night. So I'm usually up anyway at that time of night. Anyways, I said, well, why not watch Tailspin? She'd just shake her head and go to bed.
So we are going to move on to the general memories segment, and right now, as a 29-year-old, almost 30-year-old guy, I honestly, until I watched it on YouTube, I barely remembered this show past the theme and some of the characters. Now, I remember watching it when it was on, you know, the Disney Afternoon and stuff like that, and I kind of fell into the whole Toon Disney / JetX, Disney XD, whatever the hell you want to call the network now. I fell into that kind of late, so I caught the tail end of Tailspin at, you know, just going off of Toon Disney when they were pulling off all their all the 90s Disney cartoons.
Well, it's not Toon Disney anymore. They changed it like to XD. And
yeah.
And really now they might as well call it like, you know, the Marvel superhero channel.
Cause, yeah, that's true.
Yeah, because they've got what? They've got Spider-Man, Fantastic Four. They've even got the Fox Silver Surfer
yep.
cartoon on there. Yeah.
Yeah. Yeah. But, I mean, at the time, like back in 06 and 07, it was still Toon Disney, and I don't think the Jetix thing had come in until mid of 2007. But back then, I was just, you know, coming in on the tail end of it, and like I said, and just didn't really pay any attention to it. But when I, you know, when I was, you know, 14, 15 watching it, I was ready to watch every episode every day.
Oh yeah, yeah,
just
no doubt.
A really, really great show.
And since me, because I'm a big fan of like 1930s, 40s, you know, pulp action adventure, because I'm a big Doc Savage fan, The Shadow, G8 and His Battle Aces, and Saturday Morning Serials, and, you know, that whole genre. So, you know, like, Tailspin was, like, right up my alley. I said, oh, wow. I said, you know, talking animals in a vaguely 1940s setting, you know, flying planes and air pirates and stuff like that. I said, well, damn, what's not to like?
Yeah. Oh, yeah, very, very much so. See, Tailspin for me, for the setting, you know, the 1930s, 1940s, kind of like, you know, action serial type of deal, it has that feel, but it also has a futuristic type of feel, because it's not like, I don't remember the city of Cape Suzette being, like, stuck back in that era. Like,
yeah.
Like, the characters were dressed that way from that era, but, you know, the cars and all that stuff, it wasn't, like, outside of the Sea Duck, it wasn't that era of vehicle, as far as I remember. Of course, my memory is kind of vague sometimes, but all right. Well, do we?
Well, that's the thing about Art Deco, that type of architecture, which is what makes it so cool, is that, you know, even back then in the 30s, everybody loved it because it did look futuristic. And even when you do it like now, today, you have it in a movie, yeah, it's retro, but it also does look kind of futuristic. And that's what gave, you know, Cape Suzette that unique look. Because, yeah, you looked at it and you said, you automatically thought, okay, vaguely 1930s and 40s. But it also seemed kind of futuristic at the same time. Mm-hmm. Yeah.
Very, very much so. All right, I think we can move on to the characters and voice actors. A lot of these characters are really, really cool. First up, you have Baloo, who is voiced by Ed Gilbert, who I don't think that's the same voice actor as the movie.
No, that was the great Phil Harris.
Okay.
I know that because mainly because I'm a Phil Harris fan, yeah.
See, at first I thought that they were the same voice because it did sound, you know, Ed Gilbert's version sound reminded me a lot of the Jungle Book. And I actually have the Jungle Book 40th Anniversary Platinum Disney whatever DVD in the other room. I just haven't watched it in a while. So Baloo is primarily based on a sloth bear from the Disney's Jungle Book, but with a flight cap and yellow shirt and four-fingered hands instead of his Jungle Book counterpart's claws. Quite a couple of times in the episodes, he will make mention to bear necessities. Although lazy, slavish, unreliable, and always broke, he is also an excellent pilot, capable of most daring maneuvers in the air and the courage to do them. I liked Baloo in this. Again, it was something that you wouldn't normally see him in.
Mm-hmm.
I mean, who would have thought a bear could fly?
Yeah, and especially fly as well as he can, because I love it every once in a while. They'll have a scene, you know, in the show where Baloo gets a chance to show exactly why he's such a good, because he is. The bear can fly his ass off, especially when he gets pissed off, you know, and he does these amazing things with that plane he's not supposed to be able to do. And, you know, all in all, he's just a very good character because, yeah, he's kind of like the standard action-adventure type of hero. You know, he's laid back. He's cool under pressure. You know, he knows his way around all these fantastic places that he goes to. And it's really just enjoyable seeing a bear do this stuff. It is.
Yeah. Oh, yeah. Very, very much so. I completely agree. The next character up for the heroes, we have Kit Cloud Kicker, who is voiced by R.J. Williams and then Alan Roberts, an orphan brown bear who stands at little less than half Baloo's size, and a former member of the Air Pirates. In Flight School Confidential, his age is established as 12 years old. He typically wears a blue baseball cap with a red brim and a well-worn green sweater. He is skilled at cloud surfing, which is the act of riding on telescoping metal foil wing he possesses using a rope attached to a plane to maintain lift. He sometimes would fly the foil independently as well, which he could glide but wasn't able to keep sustained flight. Kit is basically, you know, as we've said, this is basically the Jungle Book in the 1930s and 40s is basically what it is, because you have Baloo, Louie, and Shere Khan, who all came from the Jungle Book. Kit is actually meant to be a Mowgli type of character.
Okay.
Because he's always looking up to Baloo. Baloo's always calling him Little Britches, like he did with Mowgli in the movie. And Kit calls him Papa Bear, like Mowgli did to Baloo in the movie. So they were pretty much trying, I think, even though the idea is original with having, you know, the air pirates and the planes and the city and all that stuff, they were pretty much trying to update the Jungle Book for television, I think, with this series.
But you know what I really like about their relationship is that, okay, when you first start watching the show, you think that, okay, well, this is the hero, Baloo is a hero, and Kit, that's his kid sidekick. And actually, it's not like that. In a lot of ways, they're like equal partners.
Right.
And there are even some times where it's almost like Kit is the adult and Baloo is the child.
Oh, right.
Actually.
Well, in the first episode, or in the two-hour movie, you know, Plunder and Lightning, you know, when Kit is at Baloo's little place there, he says, you know, you have all these outstanding bills. Aren't you going to pay them? Oh, they'll they'll give me another week, or you know, so yeah. I mean, it's the whole, you know, the kid becomes the parent type of deal, or
right. And that's why I enjoy watching their interaction so much. Like I said, it's not like Kit is a kid sidekick; he's more like an equal partner,
right?
You know,
exactly. Next up, we have Rebecca Cunningham. Oh my God, it was voiced by Sally Struthers. I did not know that. Holy crap! Wow.
You didn't know that?
It's been so long since I've actually seen this show, and I didn't put two and two together until I got the information for the show.
And you know something? I remember that when I was watching, and I knew that voice. It was driving me crazy. Yep. And one day my wife walked past, and she said, oh, that's Sally Struthers. I said, and then it hit me. I said, oh, my God, that is Sally Struthers. Yeah.
A petite brown bear with long brunette hair styled in cross between medieval 1930s-40s hairdo, usually wears a white turtleneck sweater and purple-red jacket and matching slacks. Nicknamed Becky Becker's Beck, used only once in an episode of Star is Torn, and or BC used once in War of the Weirds by Baloo, which at first she highly resented being called, but soon grew accustomed to it with affection. In return, she calls him Flyboy on occasion. A shrewd businesswoman with an MBA, she bought out Baloo's air service and his plane in the first episode when the pilot failed to pay his bank loan and renamed it Hire for Hire. Bright and unassuming, attractive, her ambitions and penchant for recklessness has caused trouble for the company at times, such as in a touch of glass when she crashed the Sea Duck's insurance policy. Oh, she cashed the Sea Duck's insurance policy to pay for expensive ads targeted at affluent clientele. I really didn't, at first, when we first meet her, I was like, okay, she can just jump off the dock.
You know why I think that is? And yeah, and know something, you're right, because I felt the same way. But if you notice, as the series gets on, because, you know, that recklessness only comes out through her continued association with Baloo.
That's true.
Because at first, yeah, like you said, she's very reserved. She's very laid back. She's got to stick up her ass and, you know, she's going to run this as a business and she doesn't want any monkey business and Baloo can't do this and he can't do that, he can't do it. But as the series progresses and she works with him more and more and more, it's like his recklessness starts to infect her.
Yeah.
Like when she gets the pig for that crazy truffle hunting scheme, she's going to get rich off of, you know, hunting truffles.
Yeah.
Now, see, that's something Baloo would do. That's not the Becky that we first meet would do, you know. But by now, she's been with Baloo for a while, so she says, well, why not get rich quick?
Well, I mean, like I said, you know, she, at first she comes off, I guess you could say, as a prude, you know, and you just want to choke the hell out of her. But as this, you know, as you said, as the series progresses, we come to like her more because she mellows out a little bit.
Yeah.
And then the next character up is her daughter, Molly Cunningham, voiced by Jenna Michaels, Rebecca's yellow-furred preschool-age daughter, an adventurous child who, even at 6 years old, is not afraid to speak her mind just like her mother. Molly has a thing for her favorite ice cream brand, Frosty Pep, sometimes pretends she is Danger Woman, the action-adventure heroine of the popular kids' radio program at the time, while seeking adventure along with Kit and Blue, can be clever on her feet when it comes to outwitting the bad guys in episodes Molly Coddled, and Flight of the Snow Duck. Her middle name is Elizabeth, and only character in the series to actually have one, revealed in Mommy for a Day. Mainly totes around her favorite doll, Lucy. No mention was ever made of Molly's father, as series creator Jin Magoon reportedly said that Rebecca is a widow, although at 1998 U.S. fan convention Q&A online chat, he did state that a roundabout tones that she is actually divorced, as originally written in the first Tailspin press release. Molly is basically Kit's sidekick. You know, like you were saying, that Kit and Blue are pretty much equal partners. She is the sidekick character for the show.
And also, she fulfills a necessary role in that, because with Molly, now you've completed the family structure. Mm-hmm. Because you've got Blue and you've got Rebecca, who are like the bickering parents.
Right.
And you have Kit, who's like, you know, the little brother, and Molly, she's a little sister, with, and I guess you could have Wildcat as the eccentric uncle, and Louie is the fun-loving uncle that lets you stay up late and eat all the stuff you're not supposed to eat. So it's a nice little family group that they've got in there, and Molly completes it because, you know, everybody, of course, she's too cute for words, and everybody loves her, and, you know, they all, when Molly comes on the screen, it's like, oh, you know.
Oh, yeah. Most definitely.
But there's one thing I wanted to touch on, that when you were mentioning about that, when they said that Rebecca was divorced and then they changed it to be a widow, I've read in a couple of places that, yeah, Disney did ask the producers and writers, you know, to change that divorce thing, because that's how she originally was written. And they were planning on bringing her divorced husband in at, you know, some point, but... You know, they said, no, you got to change that, because they didn't want, you know, the whole divorce thing. They didn't even want that word mentioned on a Disney show.
Oh, yeah. Well, that's the same thing with like, say, Spider-Man in the 1994 series. You know, they could not use any kind of negative tones as far as, because Fox was censoring. Fox got censored the hell out of stuff in the 90s, but they couldn't use death, kill, anything at all in that show. But, you know, it's the same thing here, you know. And, of course, you know, Disney wants to, you know, come out, you know, the shiny gold nickel, I guess you could say. And then finally, for the hire-for-hire crew, because Louis is classified as supporting characters, the final crew member is the Wildcat, voiced by Pat Fraley, a clueless and gangly lion who typically wears a mechanic's outfit. He once said in a comical line about having a special suit for his birthday... Officially, the hire-for-hire mechanic, actual intelligence is not his forte, but he's extremely adept at fixing devices and has childlike innocence to his genial nature. His brilliance at anything mechanical allows him to fix smashed-up telephones in under 10 seconds, and he is one of the few people in the entire Tailspin universe who can build an overdrive for airplanes. He has something of a lisp and somewhat resembles Tigger of the Winnie the Pooh series. I didn't really feel either way about Wildcat. I didn't really like him, but I didn't really hate him either. He was just there as a background character.
Well, occasionally Wildcat stood out, because there was one episode I remember. It was him and Molly had their own adventure
right.
together, because she had never seen snow. And Wildcat took the sea duck and flew her to Fimbria so she could, you know, finally see snow. And they had an adventure of their own. And if two more unlikely characters in the Tailspin universe would go off to have an adventure together, it's Wildcat and Molly.
Yeah.
But it really was a good episode. But the one I really like with Wildcat is one where him and Baloo, they actually get trapped in an upside-down pyramid mm-hmm. that's buried in the desert. Mm-hmm. And it's because of Wildcat's wonky backwards thinking that he looks at the world in a unique way. That's how he was able to help Baloo, him and Baloo, escape from this upside-down pyramid. You know, because Baloo, of course, couldn't make sense out of it because it's upside down. It's a pyramid. But Wildcat navigated it with no problem. And to me, it says something about that he's not necessarily slow or, you know, he's not intelligent. He's just got a skewed way of looking at the world that everybody else doesn't have.
Yeah, and I agree with that. I'm saying is, you know, for the most of the episodes outside of the ones that you're talking about, he is basically just the mechanic who is just there to see the Sea Duck off on its adventures, and I never really got attached to that character.
Well, yeah, that's true, because, yeah, like you said, I think that maybe it's only like two or three episodes that I can remember. Those two I definitely remember out of it, the one with him and Molly and the one with the upside-down pyramid that really showcased Wildcat. But, yeah, like you said, usually in a typical episode, he would come in, say something funny, and then he was gone.
Right, right.
And, you know, that was it, and we wouldn't see him anymore that episode.
Yep. Moving on to the Air Pirates. Now, outside of the leader, Don Carnage, I do not remember any of these characters. So if you want to chime in on any of the other characters after we talk about Don Carnage, feel free to, because all of the Air Pirates outside of him just seem like secondary characters that you just don't remember. Maybe it's that I haven't watched the show over and over again for a few years or whatever, but I when I was getting the research for this, I don't remember any of these supporting pirates.
Oh, yeah, I remember them, yeah. Yeah, they had the one, there was one of them that you never heard what he said. He always whispered in Don Carnage's ear. You know, he would never say out loud what he was talking about. And then there was another one that was like a big weightlifter type, mm-hmm, that spoke with a Dutch accent or something like that, you know. Yeah, he had like a couple. But except for them three, the Air Pirates were pretty much like a generic gang.
Yeah, pretty much. So you have Don Carnage, the leader of the dreaded Air Pirates and commander of the massive Jules Verne-inspired pirate airship, the Iron Vulture. He is some sort of canine, but it is not clear exactly what species he is. Jackal, dingo, fox, and coyote are all popular theories. Although the writers have stated that he is a wolf, he has strong accent, but again, precisely which country is difficult to tell, probably a Spanish accent. In Plunder and Lightning, however, he infiltrates Cape Suzette by posing as a gondola rower and speaks briefly in Italian phrases, a skilled pilot ruthlessly cunning with oversized ego that makes him blunder with whatever scheme or raid he conducts with his brigades, and speaks T and D as dental consonants rather than the normal English Evlior consonants. When dogfighting, he flies a hybrid that appears to be based on a low-wing monoplane, but with wings added so that it is actually a triplane. Voice actor Jim Cummings has cited Ricky Ricardo as an inspiration, but there are numerous influences present, including Billy Crystal's Saturday Night Live character, Fernando Llamas. This character is just... he is the comedy of the villains. He's just so funny with the crap that he tries to pull.
I love anything that's got to do with Don Carnage. If they had, anytime they have Don Carnage, matter of fact, they could have given Don Carnage his own show, and I would have watched it.
Yeah,
because that cat was so. And also, you got to give him points for trying. He was the Wile E. Coyote. Because he had all these plans, and on the surface of it, you say, you know something, he might just pull it off this time, and he never did. He never did.
Oh, yeah. Very, very much so. He was always getting foiled by Baloo or Kit or somebody.
Or his own self sometimes. His own ego, which was the whole thing about the character.
Oh,
yeah. Very. And I loved his accent because, yeah, like they said, okay, I had never heard that, the Ricky Ricardo thing, but now that, you know, you just mentioned it, okay, I can see that. Because you never were sure where the accent was coming from. Was it Spanish? Because at times it sounded Spanish, and like they said, at other times it sounded like it might be, okay, he might be from Italy, or some vaguely Eastern European country, or, you know, you never was really sure what that accent was, but I just loved hearing him.
Oh, yeah. Well, see, now that you had mentioned that, and now that I had mentioned about the Ricky Ricardo, it's funny, now that I've read that out, and I've seen that Jim Cummings had mentioned that that was what the... what part of the basis was for him, I want to see Don Carnage say, Lucy, I'm home.
Yeah, exactly. Exactly.
A couple of the hench pirates here, you have Mad Dog, who was voiced by Charlie Adler. You have Dump Truck, who is voiced by Chuck McCann.
Right, that was the big hulking guy with the muscles, yeah.
Okay, all right. And then you have Jibber, who was the Whisperer, by again, voiced by Chuck McCann, the pirate who whispers into Carnage's ear. He has never spoken a word louder than his mumbles. He would appear to be mildly competent, but only by the standards of the air pirates.
Right, because you never heard what he said out loud. He would always, you know, wiggle his finger, and Don Carnage would bend down, and he would whisper in his ear. And he seemed to be the smartest one out of all the air pirates. Because whatever he whispered to Don Carnage did. He said, you know something? You're right. And he would go ahead and, you know, and he would go ahead and do it. So it seemed to me like he was like kind of, I think he was the mechanic, too, for the Iron Vulture. That he was the one that kept the Iron Vulture working. But don't quote me on that.
So, yeah, those are pretty much the only ones that I really remember out of this list. I don't really remember any of the others. As we said, for the most part, the Air Pirates were just secondary characters. Moving on here.
Well, let's face it. The only Air Pirate you really cared about was Don Carnage.
True.
Really, let's face it. That's the only one. At least that's the only one that I cared about.
Oh, yes, very much so. Moving on to the other main villain of the series, Khan Industries. Shere Khan, who is voiced by Tony Jay. Now, I don't remember. I'm going to have to go look after we finish this recording and see if Tony Jay was the original. Wait, I don't know. He didn't. Excuse me. He didn't talk in the Jungle Book, did he?
You got me, because like I said, I've seen the Jungle Book maybe twice, but that was so long ago, I really don't remember much about it.
Yeah.
But didn't all the animals talk in there? Didn't they all talk?
Yeah, they did. Okay, I'm going to have to go look after the recording and see if Tony Jay is the original voice actor or not, and I'll put a note in at the end of the episode.
Wasn't he a Black Panther, though, in the Jungle Book?
No, he was the Bengal Tiger. The Black Panther was Bagheera.
Oh, okay, all right, okay. See, like I said, that's how long ago it's been since I watched it.
A Bengal Tiger who also appeared in the Jungle Book, but here stands upright and wears a business suit, is sometimes accompanied by an unnamed emaciated tiger, quote-unquote yes-man office aide. Khan is an extremely wealthy businessman who is the dominant economic force in Cape Suzette. Arrogant, dour, and humorless, he takes enjoyment of running small companies out of business. Hire for Hire is sometimes on his hit list. And there's like a whole, there's like 2.5 whole paragraphs about the character. I'm not going to read them all. You know, this character, sometimes he would team up with Don Carnage, but then he would realize better of himself. Because he's the type, they portray Shere Khan in this series like he is like the upper crust of the upper crust.
Well, he's the Lex Luthor of, you know, Crepe Suzette.
There you go.
Basically, that's what, I mean, really. Yeah, like you said, you don't really have to read out the whole thing because all you guys out there need to know about Shere Khan, that Don Carnage is the comedy villain, but Shere Khan is the badass who you really don't want to fuck with.
Yeah, pretty much.
You know, he's not the comedy villain. When he shows up, that means that Baloo is seriously in trouble. I mean, like the Air Pirates, Baloo doesn't take them all that seriously. Mm-hmm. But when Shere Khan gets into something, yeah, then you start worrying because Shere Khan doesn't play around. He's definitely not the comedy villain.
Oh, yeah. Very, very much so. He is not. He is basically, he will feed you to his piranhas if you mess with him.
Mm-hmm. Well, he kept the whole hothouse full of flesh-eating plants.
Yep.
You know, meat-eating plants, you know.
Yep. Yes, very much.
And he had his own private army, and these guys definitely were not, you know, screw-ups like the air pirates. These were competent pilots.
Oh, yeah. Very much so. I mean, he had his own army, plus he had his own police. Honestly, I think he was, you could almost say that he was the ruler of Cape Suzette.
Yeah.
Thing, because he was the government there. I mean, you know, he had those pilots, he had them for also the police force and everything else. Anytime you saw a secondary character on this show that was in that same type of, like, gray and, you know, gray jacket type of uniform with the Shere Khan logo on the side of the sleeve, you knew it was either police, fire, EMS, something. You know, I mean, he basically ran the town.
Yeah. And the relationship between him and Baloo is interesting in that, you know, occasionally Baloo and Shere Khan would work together. Mm-hmm. And Baloo, he didn't go out of his way to piss off the guy or anything like that, but yet he didn't back down from him either.
Right.
Which I think Shere Khan kind of respected about him, that, you know, okay, well, this is one guy, you know, is not intimidated by my money or my power or anything like that, you know. And you get the impression that Shere Khan respected him on that level. Don Carnage, he looked at as a complete joke. You know, he didn't take him seriously at all.
Yeah, exactly. Exactly. And the final character we need to bring up before we start talking about the voice cast of this show is, of course, Louie, who is voiced by Jim Cummings, also from The Jungle Book, is a fun-loving orangutan who wears a Hawaiian shirt and straw hat, and owns an island nightclub and motel, Louie's Place, located near but outside the protection of Cape Suzette. He is Baloo's best friend, not the case in The Jungle Book, but sometimes can be competitive with him when it comes to women, treasure hunting, and on occasion in business matters. His hold on the island is somewhat tenuous, though through his own ingenuity and aid of his friends, he has managed to avoid losing it in Louis's last stand. You know, Louis in The Jungle Book was very wacky, out there, off the wall type of thing. And the monkey scene in The Jungle Book, I remember a lot of the scenes from The Jungle Book. The monkey scene was one of the most hectic scenes ever. Because it was a big musical number. And they started singing and dancing and everything else. And I don't actually remember how many lines Louis actually spoke as far as, you know, as far as not actually singing. But in this, you know, I think he plays a really good best friend for Baloo.
Oh, yeah, yeah. And, you know, what I was saying earlier when I was talking about how the characters form like a family unit, you know, I don't consider Louis to be a supporting character at all. I consider him to be one of the main characters. And this is one of the reasons why I like Tailspin, is that you really believe that they've been friends and have a history that go back. Mm-hmm. A ways, you know, like most animated characters, you know, it's like they just exist at that moment and they didn't have a previous existence. But you believe that Baloo and Louie had an existence that happened before this show that we're watching.
Oh, right. You know, and I mean, there are even episodes when Baloo will go into Louie's and, you know, or when they're actually, I remember this, when they're actually trying to plot to stop the air pirates or something or whatever. You could basically think of Baloo and Louie as like private detectives, because when they're plotting out, they'll say, oh, why don't we try this is what we did, you know, 16 years ago against this guy.
Yeah, right.
It's exactly. that type of thing that gives you the history between them, because they've been friends a very long time.
And they even had an episode, which is one of my favorite episodes, what was it, for who the clang tolls, where they're out in, okay, it starts out, they're in Fimbria, and they're being chased by a giant walrus and everything like that. And it's revealed that in their spare time, they like to go treasure hunting. Mm-hmm. You know, that's how they relax. You know, they said, you know, let's go off, and they go, of course, they don't come back with any treasure, but this is their way of going off and spending time, you know, just the two of them, you know, which I thought was really interesting.
Right, right. Who would you say is your favorite, like, hero-type character and favorite villain-type character?
Oh, Don Carnage is my favorite villain. I mean, even though Shere Khan is, you know, more competent, and like you said, he's got all this going for him, like, he's the de facto ruler of Cape Suzette. Let's face it, Shere Khan isn't that much fun to watch as Don Carnage.
Yeah.
You know, screw-ups are usually more fun to watch than the guy who's got it all together. There's a reason why we liked on Magnum P.I. There's a reason why we liked it when Lance White showed up, you know. You know.
Yeah.
Oh, what was that? The Rockford Files. Remember? I said Magnum because it was the same guy that played him, Tom Selleck.
Yeah.
But remember that he would show up and play Lance White, the private detective,
and
had all the women and the cool car and everything like that?
Oh, yeah. Right.
But who do we like more? We like Rockford.
Yeah.
So it's the same thing here. And, my favorite hero type, well, again, Baloo, because I love that type of character, the pilot / adventurer type, because this is a guy that just can get in his plane and get up and go, and you know wherever he's going, he's going to have an interesting, exciting adventure.
Right, right.
You know, he's not, the plane is like his magic carpet. It takes him, you know, wherever he wants to go.
Right. I think for me, you know, I picked Don Carnage for the villain, same reasons. You know, it's just more enjoyable to watch him screw up than it is Shere Khan to feed his, you know, his plants, you know, his screw-up employees. For heroes, I'm probably going to go with Kit because I've always wanted to either air surf or skydive. Don't ask me why, I just have, and I think that that was an awesome thing that they had put into his character as far as, you know, being the cloud surfer. But, you know, I also, you know, think that it's awesome to, you know, for Baloo as well, so as far as the flying, but...
And that was a pretty handy gizmo, because I could, because I remember on a couple of occasions, Kit even used it as a boomerang.
Yep. Yes, he did.
Yeah. So that was a pretty handy gizmo he had, and he was pretty good with it.
Oh, yeah. So moving into the voice cast for the show, some of these people just, wow, I didn't even expect to see. You know, of course, you have Jim Cummings, you have Ed Gilbert, Sally Struthers, R.J. Williams. Frank Welker is in the show as additional voices, which majority of those are probably animal.
Is there a voice that Frank Welker doesn't do in any animated series of the past 25 years?
I don't think so. If you want to, you can go over to behindthevoiceactors.com. That's my original co-host Kevin's. He's part of that website over there, and they have like voice compare, and they have like cast listings of anything any, you know, voice actor has done as far as animation goes. Yeah, Frank Welker pretty much is the voice acting god. We've said that before on this show.
Yeah, I think that after Mel Blanc, there's probably not been a voice actor that has been so identified with animation as Frank Welker. I mean, like, yeah, I mean, if you look, I defy you to look at any animated series of the past 25 years and not see his name on there somewhere.
Well, the Marvel cartoons, honestly.
Okay.
Spider. I'm not trying to down the man, but I was surprised.
Oh, I understand. Yeah, yeah.
For that, I was really surprised when I was doing the research for that his voice wasn't in those shows. He's not in X-Men. He's not in Spider-Man. He's not in Iron Man. I don't
really.
Yeah.
Now see, that surprises me.
Not even as additional voices, he's not in there.
Because it's like some people that you look at their names on, and he says like, Andrea Romano, the voice director.
Right.
You know, is there an animated show where she's not the voice director?
That's another funny thing. It's also become a running gag on this show. In our earlier episodes, like when we covered the Nintendo cartoons, we covered Voltron, He-Man, and all that stuff, like a lot of the more 80s stuff.
Uh-huh.
I was surprised that she kept showing up as the voice director of some of those shows.
And you have to wonder, well, are there any other voice directors in animation other than Andrea Romano?
I know, exactly.
What, is this not a popular job to people get it? Does she have like a hit squad that whacks off anybody else that wants to be a voice director?
Oh, wow.
You got to wonder that, man. Seriously.
Oh, wow. Holy crap. other notable voices, again, Pat Fraley, who played Wildcat, Charles Adler, who did Mad Dog, one of the Air Pirates. I mainly know him as Buster Bunny, and I believe he also did the voice for Starscream in Transformers Animated.
Oh, okay.
Again, Tony Jay was Shere Khan. I'm trying to see. Down here on the second page, we have a bunch of just great voice actors, but just in weird, off-the-wall characters. You have Corey Burton as Mr. Sultan, or Sultan, or whatever you want to call him, Corey Burton is the voice of a lot of things, mainly Generation 1 Transformers Shockwave and Transformers Animated Shockwave. I know he's done a whole bunch of other stuff, but those are the two that pop off my head. You have Homer Simpson as Dr. Zibaldo,
Dan Castellan, yeah.
Yeah, Cam Clark, who played additional voices. Most people will know Cam Clark as Leonardo from the 1987 Turtles series. Let's see, Debbie Derryberry, oh my god, Jimmy Neutron is in this as additional voice?
You know that's got to be a real name.
That is her real name.
Debbie Derryberry.
Yeah. and then you have
Phil Hartman. I see Phil Hartman did, you know,
yep,
did a voice. Okay.
East London. Yeah. And then Dan Gilvezan did additional voices.
Robert Ito.
Yep.
Maurice LaMarche, who's another name that you always, you know, you turn on an animated show and you look at the name. His name is on there somewhere.
Yep. Oh, yeah, very much so. You had. It always really surprises me where this actress pops up, because it's very weird for me to see her outside of Ferris Bueller as the secretary. You have Edie McClurg as additional voices. I don't know what additional voices she supplied, but and then Alan Oppenheimer, who was the principal.
Okay.
Most people will know Alan as Skeletor from He-Man.
Mm-hmm.
Peter Renaday did additional voices. I know him from some. I know him from a couple other cartoons that we've covered. Neil Ross. Mostly, I know him from. He did some voices in Transformers. He was the. He did the main voice for Keith in Voltron. Let's see who else. Not really. B.J. Ward. She was in Voltron.
Alan Young.
Who was he?
He was the voice of Scrooge McDuck.
Oh, Scrooge McDuck. Oh, yeah.
Yeah, Alan Young.
Okay, well, it's been...
Go to your room, young man. You should know that.
Yeah.
You should know better.
All right, so we're going to move on to the behind-the-scenes segment. The series was produced by Jim Magden, Mark Zaslav, and Ken Sumura? I think that's how you say that.
Close enough.
Yeah, and it was directed by Larry Latham. Some writers on this show I don't recognize. Outside of Dwayne Capazzi, who I know wrote some of the Batman series.
Yeah, Dwayne Capazzi. Mark, what's that, Zaslav? Yeah, I recognize that name too.
Yeah. There really isn't any other notable... you know, for the people that were writing this show, again, great stories, I thought. You know, great involved stories that... Tailspin is a show, and we can talk about this once we get to the actual show part, but I mean, it was a show that pretty much brought you in for 30 minutes and didn't let you... It was like you were afraid to go to the bathroom until you saw the end of the show.
Oh, yeah. Yeah, most definitely. I mean, because back then when it first aired, I think we had, like, VCRs and stuff like that. We didn't have, like, DVRs now, so if you watch it now, you can pause it and go to the bathroom. Yeah. You would put off going to the bathroom until, you know, like you said, unless the bathroom was right there, you could run and take care of your business and come back because you didn't want to miss anything.
Yeah, very, very much so.
Especially when they did the episodes that were straight action-adventure as opposed to, like, the ones that were, like, light comedy or screwball comedy or whatever. But they did have a considerable amount of episodes that were just straight action-adventure.
Oh, yes. Majority of them were, actually.
Mm-hmm.
So, going into the actual show, the synopsis for it, Tailspin is set in the fictional city of Cape Suzette, a pun on the pancake dish Crepe Suzette, a harbor town protected by giant cliffs through which only a small opening exists. The opening in the cliffs is guarded by anti-aircraft artillery, preventing flying rabble-rousers on air pirates from air pirates from entering the city. Now that I think about the artillery at the two peaks of this giant mountain or cliff or whatever you want to call it, you know that this city is run by Shere Khan, because nobody else would put that kind of defense up. Like,
yeah, exactly. I mean, these big, huge, honking guns. Like, I mean, those are the guns of Navarone, basically, that he's got protected this place.
Yep. The time frame of the series is never specifically addressed, but appears to be in the mid to late 1930s. The helicopter and jet engine are experimental devices, and most architecture is reminiscent of the Art Deco style of that period. The quote-unquote Great War ended nearly 20 years ago, and radio is the primary mass medium. The series centered on adventures of bush pilot Baloo the Bear, whose air cargo freight business is purchased by Rebecca Cunningham upon his default on delinquent bills with the bank and renamed Hire for Hire. An orphan boy, former air pirate, the ambitious Kit Cloudkicker, attaches to Baloo and becomes his navigator. And again, I mean, you know, people know the gist of this show, so I'm not going to read through the whole synopsis of it. Just, you know, like I said before, and like we've both said today, it's just, it had awesome stories. It had a story for almost everybody. Every type of personality that you could think of.
Yeah, everybody, okay, as I was saying earlier, if you recall, you know, the 1930-40 serials, even if you've never seen them or heard, you know, you've heard of them. So this is what it was like. Like, I remember every time that it cut to the commercial, it would end on a cliffhanger.
Yep.
Which is why you didn't want to miss it, because you wanted to see how Baloo or whoever would get out of whatever, you know, trap they were in, or cliffhanging traps I mean, you know, this, of course, this is like one of those series because we had Raiders of the Lost Ark, and once that came out, we had that whole big boom of TV shows that were inspired by Raiders of the Lost Ark, which in turn was inspired by these film serials. Like, I remember CBS had Bring It Back Alive with Bruce Boxleitner, which was about the adventures of the real-life big game hunter Frank Buck. You had Gavilan on NBC with Robert Urich, where he played a former spy slash oceanographer. You had Tales of the Gold Monkey, which most people will say, if you ask them, Tailspin is an unofficial remake of that show.
Mm-hmm. Yeah, that kind of brings it into the trivia part of the show here. You know, the series is, as you said, was based on a live-action television program titled Tales of the Gold Monkey, which aired on ABC during the 1982-1983 season. And it's funny because I just saw, I'm going to have to look it up again. I may actually do it right now. I just saw an article on TV shows on DVD about possibly getting Tales of the Gold Monkey on DVD. I don't know if it's actually true. I'm going to look it up here.
Well, fans of the show, like me, for instance, have been, you know, begging for, I mean, you know, for it. For years, because it was a great show. I mean, it was good. And, you know, if you look at it side by side, like a lot of people didn't see Tales of the Gold Monkey and then, you know, they saw Tailspin. So when you tell them that it's an unofficial remake of that, they don't know what you're talking about because they've never seen Tales from the Gold Monkey. But when you watch, the similarities are there so much that, you know, Disney can't convince me that, well, this is just coincidence or it's a no. Somebody loved Tales of the Gold Monkey and wanted to do it as this cartoon serial, which they did.
Right. Very, very much so. Also, you know, as we've said before, you know, Baloo, Shere Khan, and Louie are updated versions of their Jungle Book selves. You know, the most notable thing is that they are wearing clothes in this series. It currently does not have DVDs as far as Tales of the Gold Monkey. The latest story is that says the title of it is Tales of the Gold Monkey. Could a tweet from show star Stephen Collins mean DVDs are moving forward? Important update. No studio confirmation, but a Twitter post from Jake Cutter says he is recording extras. You know, and TV shows on DVD.com is a great place to look for stuff like that. And they are the type of people that will not report news until they get a, you know, until they get a confirmation or until they get positive, you know, confirmations from, you know, more than one source because, you know, fake rumors have happened before.
Oh, yeah. And we all know how people on the internet love to start rumors.
Oh, yes. One bit of trivia I do have to mention is Jim Cummings did the most male voices for this show with nearly 40 different voices in all. So, yeah, go Darkwing Duck. Cloud Kicker's height is 3'9". Didn't know that. The series was originally going to feature Launchpad from DuckTales 1987 as main character, although the main character was changed to Baloo. Many elements of this early draft remained in the series, including the word tail in the title, a foul type names for most of the aircraft.
Now, I did not know that.
Well,
you know, that Launchpad was supposed to be the, you know, main character.
Right. I believe, I'm trying to remember if, there was something else with Darkwing Duck, which is actually episode 18 of Tooncast, which is, you know, it's already out. I believe that there was something else. I think that they were going to do something with Darkwing where Darkwing wasn't going to be the main foil. It was going to be somebody else, but I don't remember right off the top of my head. So I think that we're going to move straight into the music segment here. The series original music is done by Christopher L. Stone. He did 6 episodes from 1990 to 1991. And again, as we said in the intro to the show today, the theme song. You cannot go anywhere without it. Even if you hear it and don't see it, you know exactly what this theme song is.
Oh, yeah. Yeah, I mean, me, I consider myself to be a connoisseur of TV theme songs. And If I had to place Tailspin, I would say it's somewhere like my, or if I had a list of 10 favorite TV theme songs, Tailspin would probably be like 7 or 8. Really, because, you know, so it's that good. Because when you hear it, it's, you know, it, I don't know, it just makes you jump when you hear that. Let's begin it. You say, oh, wow, what's this I'm watching? And, you know, it's just, it's great. I love it.
Oh, yeah, very, very much so. And I like how, and I've said this before on the show, how sometimes TV shows will incorporate parts of the instrumental part of the theme in the show. So, like, if you have either Kit or Baloo doing a quote-unquote hero-type moment, they will play the theme, the instrumental parts of it, in the background.
Yeah.
Kind of like when, I think the best example I can give you is when the X-Men are going to fight Magneto. Sometimes, as the fight progresses, you will hear the X-Men theme in the background.
Yeah.
Of the scene, which I thought was really, really cool.
But I like the music for Tailspin, because you almost get the impression that the guy who, you know, scored this, mm-hmm. you know, that he treated this like a feature film, because the music is very, you know, it's big music for the action sequences.
Oh, yes, very much so. Well, this show actually had an orchestra behind it.
And know something? You can tell, because it's a very rich, lush music. Like I said, it's like music you would expect to hear in a feature film, not in an animated, you know, cartoon.
Right, exactly. Well, you know, a lot of cartoons are like that. A lot of the older cartoons are like that as well. I mean, just look at Looney Tunes. I mean, it had a full orchestra every episode. You look at Tiny Toons and Animaniacs. They had full orchestras for each episode.
Oh, yeah, yeah. And you know something? Your ear can tell the difference when you hear it and you say, okay, now that's a full orchestra playing.
Mm-hmm.
You can tell just from the, and like I said, the richness of when you have, even the small quiet music, even the small quieter moments we have in Tailspin, the music that's played is very, you know, it perfectly fits the mood of whatever the scene is supposed to be about. If it's a argument that Baloo is having, you know, with one of the characters, the music reflects that. It's a little bit more jokey, a little bit more lighter. When it's a more serious moment, the music gets darker and lower and moodier, you know, and when it's an action sequence, the orchestra just goes nuts, you know.
Right, exactly. Oh, yeah, very, very much so. I completely agree. I couldn't find any soundtracks for this show, which a lot of the shows that we've covered on TuneCast, a lot of them don't have soundtracks, which I think is a shame. I think that they should. I mean, you know, yeah, you can buy the DVDs and you can, you know, if you feel like it, you can rip the theme from the DVD if you want, you know, a theme song or whatever. But, you know, I don't know. I've always thought that music, the music from each cartoon that I've watched, you know, growing up should accompany, say, a DVD release or a VHS release or, you know, whatever. And it's just a shame that it doesn't have a soundtrack for it.
Yeah, how hard would it be for them to, let's say, we have, like, a Tailspin, you know, they do, like, a complete box set of all the episodes? Because there wasn't that many episodes. I think there maybe was, what, like, about, like, 50 of them, 60?
Yeah.
Maybe that's, okay, so give us a box set. You know, and also throw in a, you know, like, as a bonus, there's a CD that's got, you know, like, the score from it, you know.
Right. Well, you know, as you're saying about the DVDs, going into the Legacy segment here, the two volumes of the show have been released. Volume 1 was released on August 29th of 06 with 27 cartoons on it. Volume 2 was released November 13th of 07, which includes 27 cartoons. Now, on this, it says that the Volume 1 includes the four-part pilot. I'm not sure if it includes it as the four separate parts or if it includes it as the movie.
And notice up, I'm glad you brought that up, Michael, because, see, that's the reason I know, you know, and, you know, I've been saying how much of a big Tailspin fan I am, right. And you're going to be surprised when I tell you that I don't own the DVDs. I've deliberately passed them by because of that reason.
Go to your...
Because I don't know if that's the chopped up version. Because if I'm going to spend the money, I want to see Plunder and Lightning in its original form.
But if this is the only medium that you have to see the show, and it's not in its original form, wouldn't you want it anyway, just as a fan?
Well, you know what? I'm holding out because I'm hoping that maybe somebody will see the light and they will do it the right way and do like a box set with all of the episodes with commentary and, you know, the whole Magellan, which is really not outside of the realm of possibility because, you know, nowadays, especially Disney, they'll try to squeeze every last dime they can out of all of their properties. So maybe someday somebody will wake up and say, okay, well, you know, eventually I figure that either what will happen is that my wife will get it for me as a present because she knows how much I like it, or I will break down and buy it. But until then, I really want to hold out and, you know, see that they do it right, you know. I mean, that's my hope. I don't know. They probably won't, but hey, hope springs eternal.
Yeah, I hate to shatter your dreams there, buddy, but...
go ahead, shatter. Go ahead. Listen, I'm a married man, so I'm used to having my dreams shattered.
Well, majority of Disney releases, they don't do crap for special features. I bought the Darkwing Duck Volume 1 and Volume 2, which is the only series, the only DVDs out for that series, has no special features whatsoever.
Oh, wow.
X-Men cartoon that has just been releasing the first four volumes, which is all the cartoons, has no special features. And these are both properties that are owned by Disney, which sucks.
Yeah.
You would think with...
It blows and sucks.
Well, you will into it. You know, you would think that Disney, this multinational, multi-conglomerate, you know, basically monopolizing company... would, you know, have the time and the effort. They spend all this effort, you know, re-releasing all these original movies that they did, like Snow White. There's so many Snow White just got re-released out of the vault a couple Tuesdays ago. There are like six different versions of the thing, including the Blu-ray stuff.
Thank you. I mean, yeah.
You know, they do all this stuff with all their original movies, like 50th Anniversary Special Edition, 50th Anniversary Platinum Edition. Why the hell can't they spend 2.5 hours recording commentary with some of the producers or directors or whatever from Darkwing Duck, X-Men, or whatever? I mean, hell, they own Marvel now, so Christ, give the rights back to Marvel. Let Marvel release them, or at least add content to the X-Men stuff. I don't know.
Listen, I couldn't agree with you more. You're preaching to the choir here because, you know, I don't understand. Like you said, how many friggin' versions of The Little Mermaid do we really need?
Exactly.
I mean, Jesus Christ already. You know, and matter of fact, I was at Target the other day. I'm looking at Beauty and the Beast. There's like 9 different versions of Beauty and the Beast. Oh, please. You know, the sing-along version, the platinum version, the Blu-ray version. I mean, really? How many versions of that do we need? Go back to your older properties, dust them off, say, you know something, there are people out there that grew up watching this stuff. They'd appreciated it. You know, clean up Tailspin or X-Men or Darkwing Duck or whatever, you know, and do it upright. Like you said, get them people into the studio. I'm sure they're not exactly, they're not all that busy. And let them do commentary for it or whatever and give us storyboards and, you know, do it right. Why not?
Yeah, well... It's Disney, and they do whatever the fuck they want, so...
And know what? They can.
I know they can.
Let's face it.
Yeah.
Don't fuck with the mouse. The mouse fucks with you.
I just got a bad visual. Oh, I gotta get that... That's awful. it's become a running...
You know something? Did my work here is done.
It's become a running joke on Tooncast for us to mention the reception for each cartoon that we talk about, and we always bring up the fact that IGN has made a list of the top 100 animated TV shows, and Tailspin is ranked 81st best cartoon. I'm sorry, I say this every episode, and I will say this every episode until Tooncast ends. IGN, you are dumb bastards. Their rankings are so off. They put Mask at 99th. They put Thundercat. No, they put He-Man at 55th. God, I can't wait to find what their number one cartoon is because I'm just gonna completely shit all over that. Depending,
I have to go look at that list because I did well. IGN, I don't usually because I don't agree with most of what they say anyway. but I'd be interested in seeing that list. Yeah.
Yeah.
As a matter of fact, we should be glad they have Tailspin on there at all.
Yeah, well, I mean, that's true, but I don't know. You know, for me, with the shows that I grew up with, I don't think I could be biased and truly rank them versus number. I think they would just all be 1-1-1-1-1 all the way down the line.
Oh, I hear you. Yeah. Because, you know, certain things like that, you really hate to rank them because you love them so much. I mean, you know, like I said, I mean, if I'm watching Darkwing Duck, that's my favorite Disney, you know, cartoon. But if I'm watching Tailspin, then that becomes my favorite. You know, it depends on whatever I'm watching at the moment, you know, out of, like, DuckTales, Tailspin, Darkwing Duck, and the Rescue Rangers.
Right.
You know, whichever one of those four I'm watching at the moment, that's my favorite one.
Yeah. And there were several comics for Tailspin. A monthly comic book based on the show was published by Disney Comics in 1991, running for 7 issues, 11 counting 4-issue miniseries based on the series premiere. Bobby J.G. Weiss was the writer for the issues 1-4 and 6-7, as issue 5 was adapted from the episode 41, The Old Man and the Sea Duck. Weiss only is credited for adaptation. The comic's cancellation 7 months later terminated several planned stories that would have revealed pieces of background for the main characters. Issue 7 explored Kit's past and how he joined up with the pirates. According to a letter page in number 3, a planned story for a comic's annual would have explored the origin of the Iron Vulture. Number 4-7 would have letters answered by the characters. Huh, that's cool. Now see, this goes again, you know, Disney Comics in 1991. You know, Disney has tried several times to get into comics, and now they don't have that problem anymore since, like, Marvel.
No, they don't.
Oh, boy. So I think we're going to go into the closing and the final thoughts. What we do here is we just, you know, give our final thoughts on the show, and then if you have anything you want to plug, you can plug it, and then I just go into the official closing that I use. So what are your final thoughts on Tailspin, sir?
Okay, my final thoughts on Tailspin. Absolutely, without a doubt, one of the best cartoons ever made. One of my personal favorites of all time. I mean, great characters, great stories. Like I said, it wasn't your typical cartoon. It was like, okay, because I can remember like the first time I saw Johnny Quest. Johnny Quest was like no cartoon I had seen up until, because this was straight out action adventure, you know, done in a fairly realistic manner.
Right.
Tailspin was the same way. Here it was. It was funny animals, but they were running around doing Indiana Jones type stuff, and, you know, having these fun-filled adventures, rich characters, wonderful music. You know, I mean, I loved it. I don't know why anybody wouldn't be a fan of this show. You know, you have to have a heart of stone to say, well, I don't like it. It's a stupid cartoon. Well, you're stupid if you don't like Tailspin, quite frankly.
Yeah, I mean, I agree with you. I agree with everything you just said. I mean, it was just a great cartoon for the time that it was on. And, yeah, there are DVDs, but still, every now and then there are some shows that you just wish you could turn the TV on and say, oh, hey, there's Tailspin. I'm going to sit and watch
it. Yeah, really. And you know something? It's actually a lot of fun watching it with the – and you know something? I know everybody got to think, oh, well, I hate commercials. But you know something? It was nice to have those little cliffhangers.
Yeah.
Because when I watched it when it was on the then Toon Disney, of course they didn't have commercials, so you went immediately right from one scene to the next. And it wasn't quite as much fun because you were sitting there wondering, if you had never seen the episode before, well, how is Baloo going to get out of this one? You know, which was the whole point, because it was supposed to be like a 1930s, you know, Saturday morning serial, where you were supposed to be on the edge of your seat wondering how Baloo was going to get out of this.
Oh, exactly. I completely agree. Why don't you let us know, if you can, let us know what kind of upcoming things we are going to see in Better in the Dark.
Oh, Better in the Dark. Well, me and my partner, Tom DJ, we're going to be doing a two-part Superman thing, Superman overview, where we're going to be doing the movies. We're going to be doing the cartoons, the TV show, everything. It's going to be a humongous episode. I have no idea how we're going to do that, we're going to do it with somebody else. I can't forget his last name. He's another Michael, But he does a podcast for Earth2.net also, and he's going to be co-hosting that with us since he's the Superman guy. You know, he knows all about that kind of stuff. We're going to be wrapping up. We've been doing a series on James Bond movies, where every episode that we take two James Bond movies and we look at it. So we just finished the Timothy Dalton era, and we're into the Pierce Brosnan era right now. Right. So we're going to be wrapping that up pretty soon. Coming down the future, we're going to be doing a thing where I'm going to be reviewing all of the Nightmare on Elm Street movies. Because last year, the poor man watched all of the Halloween movies, and he reviewed all of them. So I said, well, I'm going to do a similar thing for Nightmare on Elm Street. We were going to do it for this Halloween, but we decided to hold off because we've got the remake of Nightmare on Elm Street coming next year.
Right.
So we said, well, we'll hold off and we'll do it then. So that's just some of the stuff that we've got coming up. You know, we just finished our obscure movies for Halloween, where we, you know, give our suggestions for different types of movies that you can watch during Halloween. Not like the regular thing, like the Saw movies, the Friday the 13th movies. You know, we try to give you like a little something different that you can, you know, watch. I mean, not watch. Yeah, that you can watch, you know, during the Halloween season.
Right. I'm trying to think. There was one, I don't know if you'd call it obscure, but there was one, like, spoof. You know those spoof films that they do? There was one, like, it was a takeoff, I Know What You Did Last Summer, but it was like, I Know What You Did the Last Friday the 13th or something or other with, I think it starred Tiffany Amber Thiessen. It was just this really, really weird Halloweenish type, you know, takeoff of like Friday the 13th and I Know What You Did Last Summer.
Yeah, that was like, as a matter of fact, it was like two or three of them they made like that. Because I remember I saw one on USA Network one time. I Know What You Screamed Last Halloween on Friday the 13th, something like that. Yeah, it was like two or three of them with similar titles like that were made.
Thank you for joining us here on TuneCast. There are several ways to get in contact with us or leave feedback for the show. The first is you can visit www.geekcastradio.com and find all the other GCRN podcasts there. The second is you can stop by predaconempire.com/CafeSpark. Those are our forums. The third is you can leave the show feedback on iTunes. Yes, please do this. The fourth is you can visit www.earth-2.net, find all the other Earth2.net podcasts as well as Better in the Dark there. And you can find our threads for our shows in the self-promotion section of the forums there. And the fifth is the email address, which is gcrntunecast@gmail.com. We now have a voicemail line. Call us and leave us your thoughts on each episode. Be sure to say what show you're leaving the message for and what your name is. The phone number is 502-526-5821. You can follow us on Twitter. The show name there is gcrntunecast. Mine is TFG1Mike. And have you submitted your will to Twitter yet, Derek?
That sounds ominous. You submitted your will?
Well, I don't know. Some people are against Twitter.
Oh, yeah, well, listen, I'm not that much of a big fan of it either. I mean, if you want to do it, fine, but, you know, that's not... You know what it is? I have a live journal.
Okay.
Derek Ferguson's Notebook is the name of it, and I'm on Facebook, and I can barely keep up with those. So I have no idea how people who have Facebook, live journal, blog, Twitter, MySpace, I have no idea how they keep up with that. They must not sleep or eat or shit or whatever, you know. But well, serious, but I know people who have all of those and they keep up with them.
Well, the thing with Twitter, I mean, I only use MySpace to keep up with my favorite bands. I very rarely ever log into MySpace anymore. But the thing with Twitter is, it is compatible. Like, there's a desktop application called TweetDeck. It will allow you to post to your Facebook from that application, so you don't have to have Facebook.com open and Twitter.com open at the same time and type the same thing twice.
Oh, okay.
Twitter is a really easy way for, you know, if you're going to promote something, that's fine. You know, a lot of people when Twitter started are like, oh, I don't want to hear exactly what you're doing every second of your life. It's really more than that. It's more of connecting with friends, kind of like Facebook and MySpace. You know, you get, you know, a few hundred followers on there, and, you know, you talk to them, and you know, say one guy says something about, you know, I don't know, Knight Rider or something, and, you know, if you like it, you can reply to that person, so, I don't know.
Oh, I mean, you know, listen, it's all communication, and I'm all for communication. You know, I mean, I've got no problem with it. Yeah, I know some people think Twitter is like the devil and, you know, it sucks and stuff. Hey, it's just another form of communication. That's all. If you want to use it, use it. If you don't, you don't. You know, I mean, like I said, for my purposes, Facebook and my live journal is, you know, more than enough for me. And frankly, I kind of think that I'm a pretty boring person anyway. The most interesting part about me is my writing. So that's usually what I talk about anyway. I mean, I don't talk about going to the dentist or, you know, or throwing old ladies down the stairs or, you know, my I hate my kids or, you know, my life sucks, which is what a lot of people use their live journal for. You know, I really don't think people want to hear that, yeah. You know, at least not coming from me anyway. You know? I have a wife for that.
Oh, we hope you enjoyed the episode of Tooncast and wish you'll join us next time when we will be reminiscing on Darkwing Duck. For now, I am TFG1 Mike with...
And I've been Derek Ferguson, and I just want to say, Mike, that thank you. I had a most excellent time, you know, doing this episode with you.
Yes.
Thank you.
In the immortal words of Optimus Prime, transform and roll out, and thank you for listening. Until next time.
Thank you all for being here today. I've called this press conference on behalf of myself, Ron Algar-Watt, and my co-creator, Matt Robotham, to inform you that once the current run of our award-winning webcomic, Vengeance of the Interman, is finished at the end of this year, we are hereby retiring from comics. No more webcomics for us. So that's why we brought you here, and we will now take your questions.
Al? There's no one here.
There's nobody here.
There's nobody here. Nobody read the comic.
Oh.
At all.
Oh.
Ever.
Well, we're doing a podcast now.
Yeah, we are doing a podcast now.
The Sarcastic Voyage Podcast. Available via iTunes or on the web at algar.com.